Support for the World's Podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes and Stitcher. Support for the World's Podcast comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ, or Curious Quotient, through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day at Curious.com/the world.
From Lahore to Brussels, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A deadly bombing in Lahore, Pakistan, seemed to target the city's Christian minority on Easter Sunday. But today, not everyone's so sure.
The jury is still out on the timing of it because of the 72 people who lost their lives. There were 15 who were Christians. The rest of them happened to be Muslims.
Plus, how a Belgian-Moroccan dad is trying to explain the Brussels attacks to his young sons. And the story of the French socialist who once tried to set up a utopian colony in Dallas, Texas. He left his mark on the city, even if no one remembers it now.
You know, if you go out on that street and ask 10 people, they won't have any idea, you know, of what it was. They've never heard of somebody named Victor Considerant.
The stories today on The World. Easter is supposed to be a time of peaceful celebration, but that was not the case in several places around the world this weekend. In Lahore, Pakistan, it seems Christians were targeted by a suicide bombing, and in Brussels, Belgium, residents are still coming to grips with last week's attacks, especially the city's Muslims. In a few minutes, a dad from Morocco tries to explain what happened in Belgium to his kids. But first to that attack in Lahore yesterday, which killed more than 70 people. Talat Hussein is one of Pakistan's leading journalists, and I asked him for an update on the Lahore blast.
Well, what we know about the sad attack is that it was a suicide attack to begin with. It was carried out by a youngish man, 28 years of age, and it is most likely timed with Easter, though the jury is still out on the timing of it because of the 72 people who lost their lives, 20 of them are still critical. There were 15 who were Christians. The rest of them happened to be Muslims.
And Talat, to tell me, how prominent is the Christian minority in Pakistan? Do they often find themselves under attack, either physically or verbally?
Yes, the Christians have been under attack primarily because of the fanaticism that has spread across the world. The churches have been attacked. A minister in the former government, he was killed. He was a Christian. So there have been attacks specifically directed at Christians.
Now, it isn't just a suicide bombing in Lahore that has angered Pakistanis. You tweeted that terror rules Lahore, but that a mob has taken over the capital, Islamabad, where you are. What is that about?
Well, a couple of years ago, governor of Punjab, Mr. Salman Taseer, was killed by his own guard. And that guard thought that Mr. Salman Taseer had committed blasphemy, and he killed the governor that he was supposed to guard. And that guy was hung. These people who have now come to Islamabad, the seat of power, the capital of the country, have stationed themselves in front of the parliament, have taken over buildings around the parliament, have damaged government property, and have paralyzed part of the capital city, are now demanding that Mr. Qadri be declared a martyr. They are in their thousands. And since last night, frankly, we didn't see much of a government reaction. But I, as a journalist and as a citizen who lives in Islamabad, I just felt that the government kind of chickened out. So in a way, it's very strange that Lahore has been hit by a terrorist attack. And here are people who are rooting for somebody who killed a governor and therefore committed a terrorist act. And the government seems to be helpless. At least that's what the feeling was in the last couple of hours.
Is there any chance these two events could be connected, the bombing in Lahore and these protests?
Look, we could speculate about it. There is certainly a feeling that two events actually speak of the grim challenges that the state and the government of Pakistan faces, that it continues to fumble and flounder despite the heavy cost that the country has paid. So a bit like the attacks in Brussels, I think the feeling in Pakistan is that how do you deal with these prophets of terror, these people who terrorize people, who kill people, and then also the extremists, people who root for those who kill in the name of religion. I think that's what the debate in Pakistan is. So that way, the two events are connected.
Yeah, but the connection in that the government of Pakistan is, as you say, fumbling and floundering with these problems. How are they correcting themselves on that?
The public seems to be have been exhausting its patience with the government, and that exhaustion has come to a point where it will no longer tolerate any delay in action. I mean, I could not send my children to school today, and I'm not just one. There were thousands of others because the roads were all closed. The mobile service in Islamabad has been shut down and paralyzed because the government didn't want these people to be making contacts with others and therefore enlarging their presence in Islamabad. I think these are significant changes that have taken place. Whether these changes will be sustained over the next couple of days, we'll see. But for now, at least, the government seems to be pushed in this direction, which it was avoiding taking.
Pakistani journalist Talat Hussain speaking with me from Islamabad. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Talat Hussain drew a connection there between yesterday's attack in Lahore and the ones last week in Belgium. The death toll in Brussels has now risen to 35. People have been gathering in a public square, Place de la Bourse, to remember the victims. But yesterday, right-wing protesters stormed into the square shouting anti-immigrant slogans. They tried to unfurl a white power banner before police dispersed them with water cannon. Still, most of the people drawn to the square have come to pay their respects, including a man that our friend Adeline Sia met there recently. Here's his story.
In the crowd gathered on Place de la Bourse in Brussels, I meet a man and his sons looking at the spread of flowers, candles, and notes to the memory of the bombing victims. Abdel Lahour lives in the small town of Soigny, about an hour from Brussels. He's taken his sons, Hicham and Ryan, out of school so they could come pay their respects here. We came to support people, he says, because I think it's shameful. There are no words. We can't understand why this happened. That's why I wanted to bring my two children here, to show them what solidarity is all about. Lahour lost an old friend in the subway attack last Tuesday. A really nice guy, he says. He learned about it on Facebook. He looks distraught and says his boys, who are 8 and 11 years old, are asking questions he just doesn't know how to answer. Even we adults don't understand, he says. We don't know what these people are, where they came from. And we're told these people were born here. And unfortunately, because of them, people look down on us. Abdel Lahour was born in Bouarfa in northern Morocco. He came to Belgium with his family when he was 5 years old. The fact that many of the suspects involved in the Paris and Brussels attacks were Belgians and French of Moroccan descent is extremely disturbing to him. I've been here for 50 years, he says, but since the attacks, people look askance at us. I can see why. They ask, how come Moroccans are doing this? They're not Syrian or Iraqis. They're Moroccan. I don't understand. On top of that, most of them were born here, and they have everything here. Work, unemployment, social benefits. Why are they doing this? To gain what? They gain nothing. That's what I'm struggling to explain to the kids. But it's very difficult. There are no words. Lahour says he's a proud Walloon, a French-speaking Belgian, and that he has only the smallest of ties with his native Morocco, which he visits a couple of weeks every year. Belgium is his nation, he says. That's why he's hurt that some of his fellow Belgians seem to look at all Muslims suspiciously. He says since the Paris attacks, his sons are sometimes worried about school and how their friends will perceive them. They often joke that their dad should change his name from Abdel Lahour to an unambiguously French-sounding name like Alain Larroux. That makes him laugh out loud. Luckily, in their little town of Soigny, the Lahour family is well-known and integrated. But there's an undeniable feeling of suspicion swirling around. We are shocked because there are people who confuse these guys with Muslims in general. But we have nothing to do with this. These men are not Muslim. They're something else entirely. These are people who don't think about their families, about their parents. Can you imagine how much their parents must be suffering right now? For the parents, it's the worst. Lahour's boys are looking at him in silence. You can see they grasp the gravity of the situation and the dismay of their father. And his struggle to educate his children about this shocking event is echoed by dozens of other families on Place de la Bourse who have come here with their own children to leave notes, flowers, and to try to explain. For the world, Adeline Cyr, Brussels.
Graffiti has been around a very long time, maybe as far back as the 13th century, and it will probably never go away. Some graffiti is artistic and has actually been encouraged, but how do you defeat graffiti when you don't want it? Well, given that graffiti is an Italian word meaning scratches, it figures the Italians would come up with a solution, a virtual solution anyway. Pietro Polsinelli is with the technical team that's on the case. You're in Florence. How bad is the problem there?
Actually, the main monuments are covered by graffiti, and Florence has a conservative art policy, so they can't be removed by technologies that may ruin the surface of the monuments in order to remove the graffiti. Marble absorbs the graffiti inside the material, so you would actually have to remove the marble, and by law, you can't do this.
All right, so it sounds like there are lots of surfaces, medieval, Renaissance surfaces, that have graffiti on them. And you've come up with this unique way to deal with that. Tell us what you've done.
Well, we wonder, the graffiti is not just a negative concept. There's something there. People leave graffiti on the monuments because they want to leave a sign. They have something to say. So our idea was to use a playful, persuasive technology to somehow preserve the idea of leaving a sign and at the same time preserve the beauty of the monuments.
Right. And so physically, what do you have in place to do that?
We put some tablets inside the Giotto's bell, Giotto's tower, which was covered with graffiti in the inside.
Now, Giotto's tower, this is the Santa Maria del Fiore Cathedral, right?
Yes, on the side of it. Yes, it's a huge 85 meters tall tower designed by Giotto. It's a really impressive monument, but there were so many graffiti you couldn't see properly the inside of the monument.
Right. So you go up in the bell tower, you're there at the top of the tower, and there's this tablet, this kind of iPad, I guess, something like an iPad. And what happens when you open up the app that you've designed?
Well, the app is designed as a form of graffiti. So you can choose which surface on which to design. The surfaces are the same which are available in the monument. So wood, marble, and bronze. You pick the material, you can leave a graffiti, and then the graffiti gets sent to the museum which maintains the monuments in Florence, and they're published on the web.
It's ingenious. I'm just wondering, is it working? Have you noticed any impact on the graffiti in Florence?
It's actually working beyond our most wildest expectations, because people seem they got it immediately, and we got several hundreds of those graffiti in the first few days. And you can see them online. They're all published on the website. All those with an appropriate content.
Yeah, no, it's pretty remarkable. I have checked it out.
And we've been watching people there. Some publish it, and many of them actually do the graffiti and take a picture of it with their camera. And they seem to be happy with that. And in fact, the number of graffitis done on the surface has decreased dramatically.
Why do you think it's working? Because I got to say, this can't be as much fun as real graffiti in the same way that drawing on a tablet is not as much fun as drawing with pencil on paper.
It's true. But I myself understood that it would work only when I saw the tablet in context. Because you have this incredible view and panorama, and somehow doing something that is facilitated by the context and that it won't bring you in jail in any kind of circumstance, it looks nice and it's easy to use, it actually works.
It's funny. It almost sounds like it's encouraging graffiti, at least virtual graffiti.
Yeah, the idea is to encourage, in a sense, graffiti. In a sense, respect graffiti as a form of expression, a form of art.
Pietro Polsinelli speaking with us from Florence. Thanks so much for telling us about this.
Thanks to you.
You're with the world. So here's a simple question that lots of people have been asking for ages. What's in a name?
Yeah, Marco. What's in a name indeed?
Hey, Nina. That is Nina Porzucchi, of course, one half of the language podcast, The World in Words. And she and you have been asking that question, what's in a name, over the last few weeks. This is for our occasional series called Name Tag, where we explore the stories behind place names.
Yep. These stories could be the stories of town names or street names or even building names. And we started digging into some of the questions that you have been sending us. Like, what's the deal with Zizek's Road in the Mojave Desert in California?
Zizek's Road, that's spelled Z-Z-Y-Z-X.
The word was actually totally made up by Curtis Howe Springer in the 1940s when he actually founded Zizek's Mineral Springs and Health Spa in the Mojave Desert so that the resort would always appear as the, quote, last word in health.
Cute.
Haha.
Nice.
Today, however, we have a different name tag story for you. Producer Julia Barton, she went back to her hometown of Dallas, Texas to find out a really surprising story behind the name of one of Dallas's most iconic landmarks, Reunion Tower.
All right, great, Nina. Here's Julia's story.
There's a tower at the edge of downtown Dallas, a huge concrete stalk with a round ball on top. Reunion Tower punctuates the Dallas skyline like an upside-down exclamation point. For $16, you can go up to the observation deck and look out over the city while learning about local history.
Can I brag for just a second?
Yeah.
Okay. Woodbine has changed the skyline of the city of Dallas and Fort Worth.
That's John Scoville, CEO and president of Woodbine Development Corporation in Dallas. They built Reunion Tower and the shiny Hyatt Regency Hotel next to it. Back in 1972, Woodbine consisted of just Scoville and Ray Hunt, the heir to an oil fortune. Hunt owned some land on the edge of downtown Dallas where the city wanted a big new development. A marketing firm suggested the name for that development, Esplanade. Scoville hated the name Esplanade, so he volunteered to find a better one.
I like Dallas history. I like history, period. So I'm reading about the history of Dallas, you know. And anytime you read about the history of Dallas, you will see the La Reunion Colony.
La Reunion was the name of a colony of European socialists, mostly French, who came to Texas in the 1850s and settled across the river from Dallas. Scoville's planned development was nowhere near the site of this old colony, but
when I saw that, I said, you know, that's the name.
Reunion, minus the French law. The development went forward, and it became an instant landmark. I celebrated my 10th birthday in the rotating restaurant atop Reunion Tower. I went to my first rock concert in Reunion Arena. And this was in Dallas in the 1980s, probably the most anti-communist city on the planet.
This was during the Cold War, right? And these guys were, I mean, they weren't Russians, but they were socialists.
They were.
Very hardcore socialists. Yeah. So was the dad ever come up in the room? Like, well.
No, because, you know, if you go out on that street and ask 10 people, they won't have any idea, you know, of what it was. They didn't know that. You know, they've never heard of somebody named Victor Considerant.
Victor Considerant founded La Reunion in Texas, but before that, he'd been the leader in France of a socialist utopian movement. He published a newspaper that was very critical of capitalism. Considerant had to flee France in 1849 after taking part in a failed revolution. And that's how he wound up in Texas eventually, trying to give socialism a second chance. About 300 European immigrants joined him outside of Dallas, which was then just a shabby frontier village. This is a song some of the colonists wrote about coming to America. It's set to the French national anthem. We are the holy band of workers of the future, they sing. Unfortunately, it didn't go that well. Considerant was good at persuading his fellow socialists to come to Texas, but he overlooked a lot of things. The harsh climate, the violent politics around slavery, the isolation of frontier life, and the snakes. Lots of snakes. The little socialist colony in Texas suffered. Some people died. The rest quarreled. And in the summer of 1856, Victor Considerant ran away from La Reunion and eventually back to France. So did the others who could afford to leave. But around 150 of the colonists stayed behind and became Dallasites. One of them was Chris Thévenet's great-great-grandfather, Michel Thévenet.
It was a mess, you know, think about it, all those years. And I see all these deed records of my family liquidating a lot of the land. And from what I've read, it was like nobody really wanted to do it. And once it was over, it was over. And nobody, you know, Paris was a long way away.
They failed to found a colony, a socialist colony in Texas, but more or less managed to start Dallas on its way to becoming a major city. So did they really fail?
That's French historian Michel Cordiot, who studied La Réunion. And he's right. The colonists who stayed in Dallas had skills that were hard to find on the frontier. They were artists, craftspeople, bankers, and architects. They gave Dallas a leg up at a crucial time. But Cordiot has read their letters back home. They didn't drop their idealism, he says.
Their beliefs were no longer as naive as they had been when they arrived in the USA, but they were still socialists.
That's what's so strange about seeing a shrine to them in Dallas at the Hyatt Regency Hotel at Reunion. Victor Considerant is right there on the wall.
I don't want you to think we're brilliant. No, this was just kind of, hey, you know, this is a neat name. It gives us a piece of history. It's a name that people smile when they say Reunion.
Of course, developer John Scoville is not that interested in the subversive, anti-capitalist nuance of the name he chose. But the truth is, La Reunion was a fairly obscure footnote when he plucked it off the pages of history. And he proceeded to build a landmark tower that's now a finger always pointing to that footnote. Reunion Tower and the Hyatt feature prominently in the opening title sequence of the TV show Dallas. French viewers got their own theme song to the show, and back in the early 1980s, the entire Francophone world learned to sing about this disturbing new kind of city. Turns out, it wasn't really so new after all. Back in the day, some of their outcasts helped build it. For the world, I'm Julia Barton, Dallas.
We want your name tag suggestions. Still, if you have any questions about the name of a town or a street or a building, any place name, shoot us an email at language@pri.org and subscribe to our language podcast, The World in Words. You can do that on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Singer-songwriter Carrie Rodriguez is from Austin, Texas. But when it comes to her music, it's complicated.
It's always been a little bit of a struggle finding exactly where I fit in. You know, I'm Mexican-American, but I play the fiddle, and I grew up on the white side of the tracks.
Her story coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Earlier today on the show, we talked about the recent bombings in Brussels. ISIS has claimed responsibility for those deadly attacks. But we're also hearing that in their strongholds in Syria and Iraq, ISIS is on the back foot at the moment. And observers who see ISIS on the back foot point to what happened in the historic Syrian city of Palmyra this weekend as proof. Syrian government forces recaptured the city after ISIS fighters had held it for nearly a year. Following all of this is Dr. Amer Al-Azam. He's an associate professor of Middle East history and anthropology at Shawnee State University. He's also a prominent member of the Syrian opposition. When you heard the government recaptured the city of Palmyra, what did you think, Dr. Al-Azam?
Obviously, for someone like myself, even though I'm opposed to the regime, ISIS is also an enemy, and in the case of cultural heritage, an even greater enemy. For that reason, you know, I was relieved that ISIS is no longer there. The terrible damage that they had inflicted on the site is just, incalculable, and it's a great relief to know that they're no longer there.
We'll talk about the significance of the cultural riches there in a moment, but overall, in terms of the fight against ISIS, what do you think this victory means?
For the regime, obviously, this is a very important moment. It helps reinforce the narrative that really only the regime is now able to take ISIS on, that they can take them on, that they can be successful, that they are able to recover territory from them, and that they should be seen as a real ally in the fight against terrorism, something that is obviously a major issue for both Europe and the United States. And Russia, and both Russia and the regime, have been trying to push that narrative on the international community. And Russia in particular has been saying that the only way to effectively fight ISIS is to engage the Syrian regime. And so this will be further proof of that. And remember, they're going back to the negotiations in a few weeks in Geneva, and this is going to strengthen the regime's hand as it comes back into the negotiations, having scored a major victory now against ISIS as well.
When we talk the cultural wealth of Syria and of Palmyra specifically, how much damage do you think can be repaired in Palmyra now, and how much of it is gone forever?
I mean, the Temple of Bel, I think, is beyond repair in the sense that you'll never be able to get back the original building in any shape or form. Too much of it was destroyed in that big explosion.
And that temple, one of the most important structures in Palmyra.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Whereas the Arch of the Triumph, that was never really, well, it wasn't that badly damaged in the original explosion that was used to destroy it. And the stones are still close by. I think you have a much better chance of restoring that one. And I think there's a little bit of irony here as well, in that if you know your history, you know that it's the Emperor Septimius Severus, the Roman Emperor, who erected it in commemoration of his victory against the Parthians, which are the Iranians, the Persians. Mm. And today, the Syrian forces, with the help and support of Iranian-backed militias and Iranian expertise and Iranian arms, were able to recapture the city, and in so doing are now able to reconstruct and restore that same Arch of Triumph that was built in the first place to commemorate their defeat. I just think there's a little bit of historical irony there.
Let me just ask you, how much do you think the Syrian government really cared about the cultural wealth of a place like Palmyra when they went in and kind of laid siege to the ISIS fighters in the city?
You know, we've seen before, I mean, I can't speak for this one, this specific instance here, exactly how they were dealing with it. But I can tell you that in past behavior, they've behaved very callously towards cultural heritage. So I think had ISIS maybe positioned itself within the ruins, they would have bombarded them. They would not have taken any care in trying to protect them. It seems that, however, this did not happen, or that the advance of the regime forces was too quick, and eventually ISIS decided to withdraw from the city, as you well know, and now they're on the outskirts.
So with these ISIS fighters on the outskirts of Palmyra, how much under threat are the remaining treasures of Palmyra? Can the Syrian government retain the city now that they've run ISIS out?
That remains to be seen. I mean, obviously, it took a lot of manpower and a lot of resources to get ISIS out of the city. Does the Syrian regime intend to keep those same resources at hand, you know, for some time to come to keep ISIS away from the city? I doubt it.
Amr Al-Azm there teaches at Shawnee State University. He's also a prominent member of the Syrian opposition. Let me take a few minutes to tell you a couple of stories about exploring the present and the past. In 2011, Norwegian Christian Ida broke the world record for skiing solo to the South Pole. It took him 24 days to cross more than 700 miles. And then a few years later, German mountain climber Martin Sved bested Ida's record by nearly half, skiing alone to the pole in just 14 days. Too good to be true? Well, Sved's claim began to unravel almost immediately, but not before he made headlines around the world. Now, fraud is nothing new in the adventuring world, but one man is hoping this case might finally convince people it's time to do something about it. Here's Alina Simone.
When Outside Magazine contacted polar adventurer Erik Larsson to look into Martin Sved's claim of breaking the South Pole solo ski record, he knew right away this was science fiction.
For someone who had never been to Antarctica previously, with no experience whatsoever, to smash this long-standing record by roughly 10 days was just laughable.
But Larson felt the problem went deeper, to the very heart of the question, what is a modern-day adventurer? In a world of Google Earth and drones equipped with virtual reality cameras, there are no unmapped crannies of the world left to explore.
We reached a point within 97 geographical miles of the South Pole.
Yet generations of men and women raised on the stories of Shackleton and Amundsen continue to chase the same high.
Now, the real kind of forefront of exploration is more about the how than the where. And so how can we make challenges that are more difficult?
In an effort to distinguish by now familiar feats, athletes are adding qualifiers. First person to reach the pole solo, unassisted, on a tricycle, or a snowmobile, barefoot, backward. These records start to sound a little ridiculous, but the stakes are real. High-dollar sponsorships, lecture tours, book deals.
On an expedition, it is very difficult when you are facing the potential for failure, and the finances involved are very high. And so our culture does not celebrate second place or failure. And so there is a lot of pressure, and I know that personally.
That's because in 2012, Larson failed in his own effort to become the first person to bike across the South Pole. That's Larson pedaling his fat bike over a barren polar snowscape. By definition, these ventures take place hundreds of miles from civilization. And polar adventure
doesn't really have any sort of governing body. There are no rules. And at a certain point, it's gotten to the place where basically anybody can claim any kind of record that they want. And there's very little vetting that goes on.
In an age where a major news headline is only a tweet or an Instagram post away, the temptation to lie, or more commonly, stretch the truth, is only growing.
If you look at Martin, it's what we call a fantasy expedition. It never happened.
Here's alpinist Tom Sogren. In 2002, he created Adventure Stats, a website dedicated to exploring something else, allegations of fraud in the adventure community, like the case of Martin Zved.
Then we get the other type of cheating, which is claiming you did something even though you didn't really do it. You kind of did it. You say you were solo, but you weren't really solo. It destroys the whole adventure community, and it destroys the spirit of exploration.
All this might seem like the piddling problems of a fringe sport, but the boundaries of human endeavor are defined by the extremes. These records draw the line between the possible and the impossible, the human and the superhuman. Both Larson and Sogren, who runs Adventure Stats as an unpaid volunteer, hope the adventuring community will finally unite around some core standards. Even, Larson suggests, a numerical scale of difficulty, such as the one developed by rock climbers. In the meantime, Martin Zved continues to claim he really did reach the pole in record time. He spoke to me from his home near Stuttgart, Germany, via Skype.
But I still say this what I say. I was there, I did the record, and it doesn't matter to me what they say. I challenged everybody, I challenged the whole world. I do it one more time, I show you that I can do it. I do it under your conditions, it doesn't matter to me, you can follow me, and I will do it again.
To prove it, he's looking for sponsors to fund another trip to the pole. Think about it, he says. An alleged fraud makes a last bid to save his reputation and prove the world wrong?
They will have press from all over the world. They will have articles, newspapers, TV stories, all over.
And that, at least, is probably true. For The World, this is Alina Simone.
Explorers don't just go to new places. Some also go back in time and make startling discoveries there. They're called archaeologists. And according to the magazine Science, a team of them have gone back in time to Bronze Age Europe and discovered in northern Germany what may be one of the oldest battlefields in the world. Now, they didn't just discover some old stuff. This find is shaking up what history tells us about society and warfare in that part of the world at that time. I'm joined by the world's resident history buff, Chris Wolf. So what exactly was found in northern Germany, Chris?
It was a veritable bloodbath, Marco, like a scene from some historic fantasy zombie movie, you know, where the piles of bones all intertwined with arms and weapons and personal possessions all piled on top of each other, and extraordinarily well-preserved by the bog that swallowed up the corpses in the immediate aftermath of the battle. I say one of the things that makes this find really remarkable is this amazing degree of preservation. I mean, this is a long time ago. This is if Moses crossed the Red Sea, this was before that.
Yeah, so, you showed me a picture, and some of these remains are incredibly well preserved. Like, this just happened a couple of decades ago, but much, much further back than that. What was this battle about? When did it happen?
Well, this is a river valley in northern Germany called the Tollense River. It's near the Baltic Sea, like due north of Berlin, if you're looking at a map. And it's on this strip of territory that runs from Holland all the way into Russia. It's called the North German Plain. And there was a causeway across this boggy river. Had been for 500 years before this battle, making this a vital strategic location. You can imagine guys hacking and slashing away across this wooden and stone causeway to try and take possession and get to the other side for whatever purpose. The sad thing is we'll never know what that purpose was or who these people were, because writing didn't come to this part of the world for another 2,000 years. So we have absolutely no idea who was fighting who, but we do know that these were warrior bands that had come from pretty much all over Europe, some from southern Europe, because of the teeth. You can tell by people's teeth what they ate as a child, where they grew up, and therefore, you know, what part of the world they were living in.
And when we say Bronze Age Europe, what century are we talking about?
Oh, so this is 3,250-ish years ago. Pretty much all the data points to a very specific date and a very sudden kind of termination. And another thing that indicates that it was all took place very suddenly was that none of the wounds on the corpses have healed, which indicates that it happened all in a very short space of time, probably just a single day.
So a fascinating discovery, well-preserved bones. As you say, you can really get a picture of the kind of bloodbath this battle was all about. But after that, what's the significance?
Well, no one has had any idea up to now that Bronze Age society in Europe was so organized, so stratified, and so warlike. I mean, no one has even suggested before now that you know, sadly, war and violence have been with humans since the dawn of time. But no one thought that at this point in time in Europe that the warfare consisted of anything more than bands of relatives going around maybe robbing cattle or raiding their neighbor's farm. And yet this is indicating something that we'd never expected, that there was already an organized, trained, and well-armored warrior class. And that sounds, well, duh, it's the olden days, right? But what that in turn means is that there must have been a stratification in society. You can't support that kind of well-armored kind of guy. He can't fight unless he trains all the time, and he can't train all the time unless someone else is growing his food. So that means that there's a class of laborers underneath this warrior elite that's already farming for them and making tools and weapons for the elite. And this is changing the whole idea of what people knew about how society was organized. And of course, you know, the sad thing is that this social and technological progress really means that you can bring large-scale, better organized violence into people's lives.
Yeah, the downside, I suppose. So this tells us about Europe. What about the rest of the world, like China or India or the Aztecs in South America?
Well, there are other battles that have been recorded by these early societies, as you say, India, China, and, you know, the Mediterranean world, where battles were taking place on quite a large scale. And we kind of knew that because we already knew about how organized their societies were. But even though there's historical records, you know, well, I say historical records, the Siege of Troy, for example, if it took place, happened again after this battle took place. So we know it about it from the fables and from the so-called histories, but did it ever take place? We don't know because there's no archaeological evidence. So this is what the scientists are claiming could well be the first real large-scale battlefield ever to be discovered in which there are actual remains to demonstrate that.
Our history guy, Chris Wolf, taking us back to Bronze Age Europe with his discovery in northern Germany of a very well-preserved battlefield. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. Okay, Cuba and the U.S. There has been one upside to the longstanding U.S. economic embargo in Cuba, fewer tourists damaging the island's ecosystems. But now with relations warming up between the U.S. and Cuba, environmentalists on both sides of the Florida Straits are worried about what a wave of American visitors could mean. Journalist Doug Strzok reported on this from Cuba last year. He spoke recently with the world's Carol Hills.
Are there specific species or habitats that are especially well preserved in Cuba or in the waters around Cuba?
There's a small bird that's the size of a bee, which is presumably the smallest bird in the world. There is a species of crocodile there that actually hunts in packs, which is pretty bizarre. The corals are pretty well protected. So there's biodiversity there, and there's landscape, there's geology there that you don't find in lots of other places.
Tourists from all over the world travel to Cuba. What's the special concern about opening up Cuba to American tourists?
The concern is that there will be too many of them. Lots of folks in Cuba worry that they'll simply be overrun by the number of tourists. And it's not simply the numbers of bodies. It's all of the tourist infrastructure that would have to be developed to accommodate them. Instead of mangrove swamps on the shores, you might have a hotel built there. And, of course, with the hotel, everything that's on the hotel parking lot gets washed into the water. And you have accidental sewage spills, which create nutrients, which feed the algae, which kill the coral. So it's all the infrastructure that would come with an increase in the number of tourists there.
What kind of regulations or restrictions are in place right now in Cuba to prevent that from happening?
Well, protection of the environment has actually been part of Cuba's revolution. And in 1992, Fidel Castro went to the Earth Summit in Rio and said, we have to stop the destruction of the planet's ecosystem. So the government itself has enacted quite a lot of stringent regulations to protect the environment. The big question is whether or not what's on the books will be enforced.
Outside of Cuba, historically, environmental degradation kind of comes along with economic development. Are there examples of countries where the environment has been protected while tourism has really ramped up?
Well, certainly Costa Rica. They really thrive on ecotourism, and they've done a pretty good job of protecting their natural resources in order to provide for that. Yes, there are examples of success stories. Cuba also looks at examples of failures. Places like Jamaica are an environmental disaster because of rampant development, rampant tourism. Even the Virgin Islands has lost something like 60% of its coral, in part because of the development and because of the tourism. Puerto Rico's lost more than half of its coral. So Cuba has placed restrictions and laws to protect nearly a quarter of its coastal waters. So they are striving not to become a failure.
What are you most concerned about?
Well, Cuba is a poor country. So I think when you have the possibility of increasing jobs there, when you're going to bring in money, when you're going to bring in opportunity, those forces tend to sweep away the fairly noble goals of protecting the environment. And I think that's what most folks in the environmental community in Cuba are worried about. It's simply the lure of money, of jobs in a poor country.
That was journalist Doug Strzok. He spoke with my colleague Carol Hills last week. With tourists on the verge of coming to Cuba in unprecedented numbers, protecting the cultural environment is also on the minds of some artists there. We want to take a look at one woman who's protected her own cultural environment, and maybe there's something Cuban musicians can learn from her. Let me take you to the U.S.-Mexican border to meet a Texan who is hardwired to the pop music of Mexico. Carrie Rodriguez is with us. Carrie, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Fine, thanks. So I guess you're hardwired really to pop music in Mexico through your great aunt, Eva Garza. She was born in San Antonio. I know a lot of the music on your latest album, Lola, is kind of connected to her. But I mean, she was this icon for Latinos and Latinas all over the Americas. How did that happen if she was born in San Antonio?
Yeah, well, I mean, there were a lot of women like her, actually. Lola Beltran, who was a contemporary of hers, was also from San Antonio. You know, it was a hotbed of music back in that time. She started out in the late 30s and 40s. After that, she ended up living in Mexico for quite a while in Argentina.
I am really intrigued by kind of the bilingual, bi-national identity, if we can call it that, of this music. Your aunt also recorded an album dedicated to Eva Garza, your great aunt, and we featured that a few years ago on The World. Do you think people forgot the significance of Eva Garza over these years?
Yes. She's definitely not a household name. And one of my goals was to bring her name, you know, up to the surface again. And I think a lot of the female artists of that time are pushed under the rug. It feels good to bring her music out there, and especially to put my own contemporary spin. I really had a lot of fun, you know, working pedal steel into one of these classic Mexican songs, for example.
Well, I was kind of researching a bit on Eva Garza. I found that a lot of people who know the work of your great aunt believe today she was this crucial cultural link for new arrivals to the U.S. So I'm wondering if you yourself see yourself filling that role today?
I set out with this project, I wanted to make something that spoke to people like myself. It's always been a little bit of a struggle finding exactly where I fit in. I'm born in Texas. Spanish is not my first language. It's always been a little bit of a struggle finding exactly where I fit in. You know, I'm Mexican-American, but I play the fiddle, and I grew up on the white side of the tracks in Austin. So it was kind of, this album for me was like putting my two feet on the ground and saying, okay, well, I'm a Tex-Mex gringa fiddle player, and that's my identity. And I know there are other people out there like me who were born in this country and identify with two different cultures, and I wanted to make an album that spoke to that.
What was it like growing up, as you say, on the white side of the tracks?
I was one of the only Rodriguezes in my little neighborhood. And, you know, back then, Austin was very divided. And I came home from school one day, I think I was about 7 years old, and I said, Mom, I want to change my last name. So at the time, they were busing kids from the east side of town, and so there were quite a few Rodriguezes from the east side, busing them over to the west side to go to school. So trying to mix this up. And I said, Mom, the kids with my last name, they all come from the east side and they have lunch cards. And the kids from our neighborhood, they call them these ugly names. And I don't want them to call me those names, you know? And it's just this memory. As I was working on the classic ranchera music for this record, this memory just came to the surface. It was so sad, but it turned into a song.
Wouldn't you like to grow up? Here we got big old houses coming out our ears.
This is the track, The West Side, off Cary Rodriguez's new album, Lola. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
Wouldn't you like to go to our school where the moms are pretty, dads are cool, and they're fancy SUVs line up at carpool?
PRI, Public Radio International.